Michael Moorcock. Welcome to Sphinx Radio.
Hi.
It's very nice to have you here. Now, in 1989, I was friends with Fritz Leiber, the very famous science fiction writer, and I was doing a master's degree in philosophy at the time, and Fritz used to actually help me with my thesis, which was on St. Augustine, and he actually had a degree in theology, and one thing he never liked to talk about was science fiction and fantasy and horror with me, which is what I liked. He always liked to talk about philosophy. So one day I forced him to think about what the three best books would be in the horror, science fiction, and fantasy genre. And this is what he came up with. For horror, he said The Shining by Stephen King. And for science fiction, he said it was a tie between Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep by Philip K. Dick and Behold the Man by Michael Moorcock. And for fantasy, he said he thought it was The Warhound and the World's Pain by Michael Moorcock. So you got on two of his best list.
Yeah.
For a time.
I didn't know that at all, you know. He never said that to me, ever.
Well, I had to kind of force it out of him, to be honest.
Yeah.
Because he really didn't like many other science fiction writers and fantasy writers.
Well, I'm pretty much the same. Fritz is one of my favorites, absolute favorites. I thought he wrote just a beautiful prose. It puts everything else to shame. I was in a collection with him, Nebula Awards winners, I think it was, and there were some, you know, pretty famous names there, and I was in there, and Fritz had a story in there, and Fritz's story was so much better than any of them. I mean, including mine. It just shone out, and I found that with all of the, you know, everything that he wrote was like that. He was a very fine writer.
Right. Now, you also, in your career, you met C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien. Is that correct?
Yes, I mean, when I say met them, I mean, it wasn't for very long where Tolkien was concerned. He was very nice and polite to me, but I didn't get to stay very long.
They just emerged as such big characters with the Lord of the Rings film and the Chronicles of Narnia. And what is your opinion? You have some very interesting opinions about those two.
Well, I mean, Lewis used to come to a pub in London called The Globe, where all the science fiction people met. And it was very small and egalitarian in those days. Everybody knew everybody else. And certainly neither Lewis nor Tolkien were seen as being, or saw themselves as being, you know, especially different or superior to anyone else. I mean, a given evening at the Globe, you could get Arthur C. Clarke, John Wyndham, C.S. Lewis. Tolkien never came. But it was through Lewis, I think, as I recall, I was only about 15, 16, that I got to meet Tolkien in Oxford, at his house in Oxford.
Oh, quite interesting. Now, Fritz always believed he liked The Hobbit, but he thought The Lord of the Rings was too long. What is your...
Yeah, well, I agree. I never read The Hobbit. I honestly, when I was growing up, again, those books, well, certainly The Hobbit, because I think I was probably about 15 by the time the Narnia books started coming out, so I felt too old for them anyway by that time.
Right.
But they weren't, again, you know, they weren't seen as anything especially outstanding. I mean, they weren't seen as bad, but and some people obviously liked them better than they liked other children's books, but they were just seen in the general, you know, as the general run of decent children's books. And I think it was really the sort of the cult side of Lord of the Rings that started to make it seem to be the sort of template fantasy, you know, against which others were judged. And I certainly never, you know, I'd like Fritz, I'd read a lot of fantasy before that, and I certainly didn't see it as being particularly outstanding. And I saw it pretty much as the work of an academic who frequently forgot story values, as it were, because he just got sort of interested in all the kind of academic stuff the sort of academic games that he played. But I hadn't actually read Lord of the Rings when I met Tolkien. Somebody sent me a copy of a letter that I'd written to him around the time in which I'd said in which I said I'd like to meet him, because I was running a fanzine at the time, and I was interviewing any fantasy writers that there were around, and I admitted completely frankly that I hadn't read any of his books when I asked him for the interview, and I thought he took it very well, all things considered.
Very good. Now, just to hop subjects a bit, my favorite book of yours that I read was Behold the Man, which I read about 30 years ago, and that got me really interested in theology and the ancient Near East. Now, just to sum up, this is a book about a man who goes back in time to meet Jesus Christ, and he finds him, but he decides to take on the role of Christ himself, and that was considered one of your masterpieces. Even the snobby literary critics at Harvard University here in Massachusetts like that book. Now, did anyone ever plan on making a film of that movie?
Yes, several people have thought about it, but the best one was the first one, really. An actress and director called Maya Zetterling, who had been a pretty big star in England, and she was really too smart for the kind of role. She was a very beautiful woman, and they tended to put her into glamour parts, I suppose, generally speaking. And she went back to Sweden, where she'd been born, although she'd been raised in Australia, I think, and started working for the Svensk Film Institute, the same company that Bergman did his films for. And she made about five or six films there. And Behold the Man was the movie that she wanted to make, the first one she wanted to make in England. And we got as far as a script, and I really liked what she was going to do with it. She was going to, my view, was going to improve on it. She was used to working with very small crews, and used to working in the kind of atmosphere of the Svensk Film Institute, which, as you know, is a state-run film company, so you've got a lot more freedom, and they don't worry so much about immediate profits and so on, or didn't in those days. And she just ran into a lot of problems with producing it in England, and eventually gave up, and gave up with my blessing, because I saw that she couldn't, she wasn't going to be able to make the film that she wanted to make. And since then, there have been people who've again come along and wanted to make it, and then for various reasons, just haven't been able to make the book that I wrote. And these days, of course, it's even harder to get people interested in doing that kind of story.
Oh, I know. I think it would be as provocative as like The Last Temptation of Christ or one of those sorts of films. Did you get a lot of flack from evangelical Christians about that book?
Yes. Oddly enough, I live in Texas part of the year now, and Texas is where I actually got the only death threats I had.
Oh my!
After the book was published, and my answer to anybody who complained about the book was to send them back whatever they'd paid for the book. I'd send them the money back, because they were obviously a dissatisfied customer.
Well, that's fair. That's fair.
That seemed reasonable to me. But generally speaking, I got extremely good reviews in the Catholic press, in the Anglican press, and in the Jewish press. It was surprisingly well received. I got fan letters from religious people. I had a nun in, I think she was in Pennsylvania. She's dead now, but she used to write to me. Understanding that the book wasn't in fact an attack, but an analysis, and they, you know, I didn't have many people, many people of faith actually taking me to task for the book, except for the evangelicals, you know, I suppose because it didn't fit with exactly a fundamentalist view.
Wow, that is like one book I would love to see as a film, to be honest. It's really thought-provoking. It really is a fantastically thought-provoking book.
Well, thank you.
And what do you see as the future, really, of science fiction? What's your opinion of the Internet?
I'm a great fan of the Internet, as you know, for everything it does for, as far as communication and information is concerned. As far as science fiction is concerned, I don't actually read that much. I've never really read. I edited a magazine called New Worlds, which many science fiction purists didn't think was science fiction anyway. I read, of course, you know, the stories that I published there, but I've probably read about 10 science fiction or fantasy novels in the last 20 or 30 years.
you forge ahead with your own projects, huh?
I suppose that's it, yes. Yeah. I still try to give publicity to new writers. So I review for the English newspapers. So every so often I will review a book.
Right. And what papers are those? Because they're quite big.
The Guardian and the Telegraph mostly, and the Spectator and the New Statesman are the others.
Well, I don't think an American newspaper like the New York Times or the Washington Post would have actually a science fiction writer review anything.
I used to work a bit for the Los Angeles Times.
Oh, did you? They actually gave you some work here.
Yes,
wow.
Yeah.
Wow, it's very rare for science fiction writers. They're very seen as kind of...
Well, don't forget, I've written an awful lot of non-science fiction. I mean, as I said, my initial books weren't reviewed as science fiction. And I write a whole... variety of other kinds of novel, mostly, I suppose you'd call them contemporary novels. So I'm in a sort of lucky position, and in England it is a lot easier. I mean, Ballard works regularly for reviews regularly, Aldous reviews regularly, and by no means, I mean, none of us really do much in the way of genre reviewing. It's pretty much general reviewing.
Oh, very good. Now, to hop topics a bit, you were also a musician part-time in the band Hawkwind, is that right?
Yes, I was with Hawkwind. I was a substitute frontman. A friend of mine was the frontman for Hawkwind, but he's dead now, unfortunately, and he was bipolar, so he tended to... be institutionalized part of the year.
Oh my!
and so because it wasn't my regular job, I would stand in for him while he wasn't available, and that way he knew that when he came back, his old job would be waiting for him. I wouldn't be taking over from him.
Oh, very good. Now I was reading something Lemmy wrote, who went on to form Motorhead, that he came near your house once in England, and there was a leave me alone note that you kept on your...
Oh, it was my house, yes, yeah. Yeah. It was a bit stronger, more strongly put than leave me alone.
Right.
In those days, in the 60s and 70s in particular, I became, I suppose, a sort of cult figure. And where I lived in Ladbroke Grove was the sort of equivalent of Haight-Ashbury in San Francisco. So pretty much everything was going on in the area that I lived in. I mean, I lived there before things started to happen, you know, but I was already there, as it were. But almost every second house had a well-known rock and roll band, or you know, somebody involved in the underground press or poetry, or you know, whatever. It was that sort of a neighborhood.
Oh, right.
And now, of course, it's Notting Hill, and now it's far too expensive for poets and...
That's what happened to Haight-Ashbury, too.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, they got priced out.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, you have a webpage...
at www.multiverse.org. Multiverse.org.
It is multiverse.
What I've got is a question and answer, really. I don't have a blog as such. I don't detail my my daily life and thoughts.
Oh sure.
But I answer questions from readers, and I do that pretty much it's on a regular basis. While I'm at home, I try to keep up answering questions, and those questions turn into conversations, you know, quite often.
Oh, that happens, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
What projects are you working on now? Do you have any books coming out in the next
I've just completed a very ambitious set of books, which haven't appeared over here yet, which are really dealing with the Holocaust. They're called the Colonel Piette Quartet. And they're about a very sort of elaborate story of a very unreliable narrator who tells the story of his life between about 1900 and 1975 when he dies, and they're mostly dealing with the Holocaust and the causes of the Holocaust. And I've just finished that, and I'm currently writing a memoir of Mervyn Peake, who is a friend of mine, the author of the Gormenghast book.
Oh, right.
I've usually got several projects running at once, but that's the main project that I've got to complete at the moment, and then I'm writing a another memoir for a French publisher, because I live part of the year in France, and that's just somebody wanted me to write a memoir, you know, about my early life, so I'm doing that.
Oh, very, very good. Now, just one more time, your webpage is, what's it called again, if people go to search
it? It's called Moorcock's Miscellany, and I think, I mean, you can, if you Google it, it's usually the first...
Yeah, Michael Moorcock in Google or Yahoo,
yeah,
or something like,
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
Well, I'd like to thank you very much for coming on to Sphinx Radio, and I will read those Holocaust books. That's something I focused a great deal on myself.
Oh, good.
And
yes,
we'd love to have you back sometime. Thank you.
I'd love to be back. Thank you.